This podcast is brought to you by lineupmedia.fm. This is Baseball Outside the Box with Peter Caliendo. Innovative thoughts from baseball's best coaching minds from around the world. Brought to you by lineupmedia.fm. Now your host, former USA Baseball National Team Coach, Peter Caliendo.
Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending where you're at in the U.S. and around the world. Thanks for joining us for today's show. I am your host, Pete Caliendo. We thank you for joining us. We're going to have another great one. Before we start, I wore my red shirt for you, and I'll tell you why, because all we ask is that you go to YouTube at Peter Caliendo, and there's a big red button, just like my shirt. Hit that button, click, subscribe to the show, get all the updates on the shows, and you're doing us a favor. You're helping us get the show out. To all your coaches, players, and parents, this show is great for everybody in the world in baseball. So please share the show. Don't forget, people on Facebook, I see some names already. You're going to be able to see me. I know you want to see the guests, but if you want to see the guests, you're going to have to go to YouTube, Peter Caliendo. It's live right now, or you can stay on Facebook, ask any questions you have of our guest. Let me tell you about our guest, matter of fact, and we're going to have a great one here. Why? Because he's got a tremendous amount of baseball experience. Unbelievable. I can't even read the whole resume. There's no way. But he is the Cubs Latin American field coordinator, and we're going to get into the Dominican Republic especially, and also Latin America. But he's been a pro coach manager for many years. He was the MLB coach with Cleveland, so he was in the big leagues with Cleveland, minor league coach with the Chicago Cubs, and also between 204 and 212, and we're going to get into this, the minor league hitting coordinator at that time also. So we're going to talk about that, about hitting. We're going to talk about the Dominican Republic. We're going to have a lot of fun. Let me welcome our friend, and I really appreciate him being on, Dave Keller. How you doing, David?
Everything's great. Thanks.
Off the air, we were talking, everything's great in a lot of ways, but you and I have been shut down for 10 months. You know, we're guys that love to get on the field and travel the world as you go to the Dominican. Like me, what have you been doing pretty much to not just to keep yourself busy yourself, but also, you know, baseball-wise, to always stay on top of the game or maybe, communicating with your club or teams or players? What have you been up to?
Well, as an organization, we've had a ton of Zoom calls way back from all the way in the end of March with all of our different departments once a week. I know that all of our hitting coaches, they have something going on every Friday. We talk to the kids that are international. And so those calls, we just try to keep the kids connected a little bit to talk about situations offensively, defensively, base running, how they're working out. Our nutritionists have gotten involved to try to talk to the kids to keep them aware of how they're eating. Our strength and conditioning coaches are real active with the kids because it's kind of off season if you really look at it for what's going on with the minor leagues because they haven't had a chance to have any games. Mm-hmm. So we're getting close to turning the corner, I think, where we're going to have games in Arizona with our instruction league program that's going on there right now. There's a lot of teams that are being proactive with this. I think there's teams in Latin America that are being proactive as well.
Fantastic. And folks, you know, again, you can hear Dave, but you can't see him. If you want to go to YouTube, that's fine. Go to YouTube, Peter Caliendo, and check it out. We're both on there live currently right now. And people know that I'm from Chicago, obviously. I root for both teams, but I'm more of a Chicago Cubs fan. And more importantly, because of Theo Epstein, following his career, and the organization, just a quality organization from top down, that you just hear great things all across the board. And, you know, one of the interesting things, Dave, an area I'd love to really start into because, you know, I know you love hitting. You've been big on hitting. I'd love to get your opinion on a little bit about, you know, all the years that you've been a hitting guy, some of the positive changes you've seen in hitting and also some of the things that possibly let's get into some of the things you may think might be detrimental. And I know where it's broad range because we could be talking about, you know, coaches that are listening here from in the US and around the world at all different levels, even coaching the young kids, you know, 12 and under. So what's been some of the changes? Let's talk about the changes first that you've seen that's really been beneficial in hitting.
Well, I think probably the biggest change that they've kind of implemented into the whole hitting philosophy over the last few years is all the technology and how they evaluate players. The game's the same. Baseball's the same. I don't think it's ever going to change, but the way that people are evaluating the game these days is different. And they're using a lot more technology and numbers to try to come up with reasons and answers for developing players. From a hitting standpoint, you know, it started probably in the middle 90s, I think, when everybody started getting a guy. And everybody had a guy, you know. And I remember my first year coaching in the big leagues with the Indians in 2001, a couple of players told me, well, my guy that I work with in the winter, and I'm like, your guy? Who's your guy? You know, and it's gotten to the point where everybody that's out there, I mean, and I'm helping out with a 17 and under team right now, coaching in Denver here with the fall program, and I helped out with the summer, and they all have their guy. They have a pitching guy. They have a hitting guy. They have an infield guy. They have a nutritionist. So everything's become very, very individualized. And I hope that we never lose the aspect of this is a team game and it takes a team to win. So things have changed a lot with the technology. I think what we have to keep in mind the whole time is how to use it and really make it stay simple for especially the young kids, because they're not ready to handle all that information. So we have to be able to give them a little bit at a time and see if they can handle it.
That's a great point. And, you know, one of the difficulties would be, you know, and maybe get your recommendation, you know, what does a coach do when they're in that situation where, you know, you're working with your team and obviously you got to work with your hitters, but yet they've got a private hitting coach. I would assume there has to be some kind of communication between yourself and their coaches, or is there another way to handle this?
Well, I've always tried to realize that it's about the player, and I don't want to give a different message than somebody else that they spend more time with, or they spend all their time with in the winter. And then that guy watches video during the season and then tries to evaluate what they're doing. Because there's this thing called the human element that's never going to change for me. And you can do as much teaching and coaching and all that, but you have to be able to understand the player from the neck up to be able to talk to them. So I always try to make sure that I ask questions to the player, because I want to know where the player's coming from. And he basically what they do is they just repeat the information that they're getting from their guy,
right?
Which is fine, you know? And so the more you ask questions to the player, I think the player realizes that you care about him. You want to make sure you're sending him the same message and realize that, you know what, there might be a couple words that are a little bit different, but they mean the same thing. So we all have to be on the same page with that, because everybody thinks that they want to be a great coach when they get into coaching, and they want to coach these kids so much, but they also have to realize that if there's 5 or 10 coaches trying to coach one kid, the only person that's going to get confused is the kid. I'm not. I know what I'm teaching. I know what I'm talking about. I know what I'm dealing with the players at just about every single level. And I've been really lucky to be able to coach at every single level and talk to players that are Hall of Fame guys like Tomey and Sandberg, and deal with guys that are rookie ball players. So you realize how to deal with all those guys and talk to them about the game. And so you have to keep it simple with the player so he doesn't get confused about what you're talking about.
Absolutely. You know, and something you said was interesting, and that was, you know, ask questions. I remember asking questions, and then sometimes you get the standard answer. I remember asking several players, I believe I was in Canada, and I said, do me a favor. I'd like to know when you're hitting, whether it's in the cage or whether it's in the game, what are you looking at? Well, you know, I got the standard answer was, well, I look at this and then I move to this. You know, but then some guys didn't know what they were looking at. They were just looking. So what I'm getting at is this: vision is extremely important. So what are some of the criteria, the critical areas that you think are important? Because there's so much to do to work on hitting. What are some of the areas that you focus on the most with most hitters? I would assume vision would be one of them. What else would you categorize very important?
Well, to keep it, I don't think this is ever going to change. To keep it really simple, it's rhythm, balance, and timing. Mm. And then that leads into the hand-eye coordination that you deal with each player. So when you watch players hit and swing, I watch to see how they make contact or how they don't make contact. Because I think with all the cycles that we're going through on the different kinds of hitters and what people think's important, is it more important hitting home runs or making contact? We've gone through a big phase here where nobody seems to care if you strike out. And that bothers me to no end, because we're trying to teach these guys how to control the barrel. And that's basically what it is. If you can control your barrel to make contact, you have a chance to get on base. And nobody wants a guy that swings and misses. They're really, really hard to teach somebody that swings and misses a lot. Very, very hard to teach them to make contact. So is it visual? Is it anxiety in their mind? Is it their body's out of sync? Their body's in the bed in a wrong position, or a very, very inconsistent position? There's a lot of different factors that come into play. And those are things to me that as a hitting coach, you got to be able to break down every single guy and understand it.
Hey, a good friend, I'm going to go to Facebook real quick. Good friend of ours. You were just on the phone with him. I go back in the history of Belgium baseball when I was a national team coach there. Actually, he should have been a national team coach at the time, not me, because he was pretty good. Steve Jansen says hello. He's now currently the German national team coach. So he just wanted to give you a shout out. I got a lot of guys on Facebook. Thanks for joining us, everybody. You know, I had Jay Ward when I started in 99 Thunder Bay Independent Ball. Jay Ward was the hitting coach. Rest in peace. A good friend of mine I met at Mickey Owen Baseball School. Jay always talked about the hands, how important they are, because you mentioned the hands. You know, the hands are, because I always ask kids, you know, if you're going to put the barrel behind the ball, what's going to take the barrel behind the ball? Your hands are pretty important when it comes to that, aren't they? And kind of explain that, what you think.
Well, yeah, I was with Jay. Jay and I were together with the Cincinnati Reds for a couple of years.
Yes.
And, so before that, he worked for the Phillies. And he was a very, very passionate hitting coach.
Yes.
And he believed in a lot of attitude as a hitter. And I've thought that same thing as far as inner arrogance goes with a hitter. You have to be, when you get in the box, it's a war. And you have to have that inner arrogance to be able to compete. So the other part of it is that you have to be extremely relaxed, because you don't know what pitch is coming. You don't know the direction that it is. You don't know the location. And the more you can stay tension-free with your body and relaxed, the easier it is to react. The easier it is to take the barrel to the ball and make contact.
So, Dave, let me ask you, since you mentioned relax, sorry to interrupt. Interesting. Stay with that, because I want to ask you, maybe for our coaches to understand this also, and myself, what are some things you can do, I guess, in some ways to train yourself to be relaxed?
Well, the two things for me is the way that you can relax your chest is listen to yourself breathe. And that sounds like a really corny kind of cliche, but when you're standing there, try to listen to yourself breathe, because you have to relax to do that. Mm. The other thing is, some guys will move their fingers on the bat. And as they're doing that, they move their fingers to kind of help them with a little bit of nervous energy and a little bit of relaxation mode. Because as things start progressing into the windup and you start seeing a pitch, you have to slow everything down to stay relaxed. If you start speeding up, everything tightens up. And if you're tight, you lose your bat speed. If you're tight, then it's really hard vision-wise to see. So when you're talking about being relaxed, you can really look at a guy's neck a lot of the times to see how relaxed they are. And so for me, I like guys with just a little bit more of an open stance than a closed stance, because it frees up your neck to be relaxed. And even though that front shoulder might be just a little bit open, it frees up your neck so you can see the pitcher. Mm. Some guys get in there and they really strain to turn their head, and that constricts your blood flow to your brain, which affects your vision. So, you know, just like a long time ago when people said, okay, we're not playing pepper anymore because pepper's not valuable and we don't like it and it's boring. When you get set up in your stance, when you play pepper, you have a little bit of an open stance and you're just kind of using your hands to try to make sure you hit it on the barrel and you understand direction, you understand angle. And so that helps, I think it helps your neck and it helps your vision and it helps keep your chest relaxed.
You know, I love hearing that. And then the other part you mentioned was pepper. I can't believe people would think pepper is boring. I can't believe they think that it wouldn't be good for you. There's so much that happens in pepper. We could do a show just on pepper, how much training that can help. But what I love also what you said, another key word you mentioned, which is kind of underestimated because everybody thinks it's, well, it should happen anyways. And that's balance. Balance isn't as easy as people think it is. So I really want you to address that, address balance and how you train for balance. And I just want, before you start, I want to mention, because I watch batting, when I go down the Wrigley Field and all I do is watch batting practice. And then I go home because I watch the game on TV. All I see is guys hitting the ball hard, but man, they stay balanced from start to finish, every swing. I don't know if it's their goal they're doing that or if they're just, they've done it so much that it's just natural to them now. But how do you work with guys on balance?
Each guy's different, obviously. And I look to see if guys get on their heels too soon or they get on their toes, if they start to lean. Over the years, I think I've gotten a lot more detailed on body position. Instead of worrying about what the swing looks like, because I think everything happens two or three or four clicks before you start to swing. And what I mean by that is if you get ready late, everything breaks down and the whole hitting mechanics that you want to have and the whole good swing that you want to have goes away because everything's rushed. And when everything's rushed, you're tight. And when you get tight, things move very, very slow. And most of the time what happens is you put yourself in a bad position, you take a bad swing. If you put yourself in a relaxed position where you're balanced, then it's so much easier to feel free and easy when you hit. Obviously the younger kids that are in the lower levels of the minor leagues and some of the kids that I'm seeing in high school, their setup is crazy from the beginning. And so it's like, how in the world can they expect to hit with the setup that they have, either their hand position or how their feet are, if they're close to the plate or far away from the plate, all those things come into play. And so when that front foot lands, that's when you're talking about the balance. And so I really kind of watched that as my key. When that guy lands, I want to kind of see where everything is with him.
So when he lands, if he's in pretty good position, body posture wise, he has a better chance of staying balanced throughout the swing.
Absolutely. And that's what, for a long time, you know, I started when I was just standing next to the cage and you're not sitting there with your phone or a video camera or whatever, I would start closing my eyes as guys were swinging. And people were like, what do you do that for? So if you think about it, when you watch a guy swing, you can close your eyes and it becomes a still frame for you because the last thing that your eyes saw, it's like taking a picture. And so when that guy's foot lands, if I close my eyes, I can see exactly where his hands are. I can see if he's close to 50-50 when he lands, or if he's like 70% of his weight's on his backside and 30s on his front side. And because to me, that's a quick guide for me to say, okay, let me give this guy two words to get him to feel where he is. And that has worked for me. And I, I've tried to like get it to other hitting coaches, younger hitting coaches that are trying to figure out how much information to give guys when they're hitting in the cage or when they get out of the cage. And if you close your eyes, it takes a picture, and you can do it with anything you want. If for anybody that's out there that's playing golf, you can do it with whoever you're playing golf with and see exactly the same thing, because that movement will stop and it will be like a still picture for you. And then you can open and close your eyes at different parts. You can close your eyes when they're coming through with their swing and you see contact. And then you can say, wow, too deep. Ball was middle in. He made contact way too deep. And then you see everything change with the guy's swing and all those mechanics are different. Well, you can see that right away because he just showed you the picture of what it looks like.
Dave, you talk about the eyes for a coach. You know, obviously a video camera can pick up a lot more. When's the time that you possibly then go to the video? Is there a particular time where you say, well, you know, my eyes aren't going to be able to pick up certain things and maybe I'm not seeing it right? Do I go to video?
I think you can do it before and after. And I think you know, we weren't going to talk a lot about the big leagues, but I'm going to throw this at you. Because yeah. It kind of got talked about, but I think the big league players of today got a little bit overwhelmed because they didn't have video over these last 60 games, 70 games. Absolutely. I think so much over the last probably close to 20 years now, video has taken over so much that those guys become dependent of that video. And I remember when I first got to the big leagues as a coach, every time an at bat was over, guys disappear. And I'm like, where are they going? Stay here and watch the game. And everybody was going down and pulling up their video and watching their at bat to see what happened. And I think what ends up happening over time is you get so dependent upon that video, you get so dependent on what's going on that you lose a little bit of edge about competing, preparing for your at bat. And there's been a ton of players that go down there and they get mad, they get upset, they complain because the ball's this far outside and they thought it was a ball and it wasn't a strike. Right. But one of the best things that I've learned from the video was when I sat down and watched video with Robbie Alomar when we worked together in Cleveland. Because he wanted all the video from behind home plate. He didn't want any video from the side. He wasn't watching his swing. He wasn't watching anything that had to do with his hitting. He wanted to look straight through the umpire, the catcher, him as the hitter, and he wanted to try to pick up something on the pitcher. He wanted to try to pick up something that he did with his hands or turning his glove or doing something, fanning out his glove so he could get that edge on the pitcher tipping pitches. And he was phenomenal with that. So he didn't care about his swing. He knew what he wanted to do. He knew exactly what his plan was when he hit it, when he went up to hit. And so he didn't get too hung up on the video part of everything that's going on.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I really love that. And I do love that you brought that up because being in Chicago, I know I'm a big Javi Baez fan, obviously, you know, and I knew he struggled with that, you know, but you're right, because if you're looking from behind, you're looking at the pitcher, that makes sense. But if you're trying to identify all the time your mechanics, I mean, that's one of the things we tell a lot of young kids is when you go to hit, forget all that. Worry about the ball and the pitcher. Don't worry about what you're doing. Because mentally that's got to be tough. So I can't see a major leaguer going in there and worrying about his mechanics. Now, are they worried about, did I swing under the ball or over?
I think that they don't worry too much about their mechanics.
Okay.
They're just looking for something within that pitch sequence of that at bat to try to reinforce what they're thinking. I think there's a little cycle that goes on with players professionally that I've seen. When you first start out in the minor leagues and you're at the lower levels, people talk about mechanics a lot because they're trying to clean guys up to make them a little bit more consistent, so they're prepared to face better pitching on a consistent basis. Then as time goes by and you get to high A and double A, there's a lot more emphasis on what goes on mentally and how you prepare mentally for at bats and how you remember how pitchers pitch you and situations of the game and on all those things that go on from high A to double A become extremely important from the neck up. And then in triple A, you try to put it all together. And then what I've seen, and whether they're an all-star or a 10-year big league player, a lot of guys in the big leagues go back to mechanics. They already understand the whole mental part of it. You know, I remember talking to Maddox one day in spring training way back early, like in 2004 or five, and he's breaking down every hitter while I'm watching him hit. He's telling me everything. He's breaking him down. He's telling me if I throw this pitch, if he swings at it, I'm going to come with this. If he takes it, I'm going to do this. He didn't have any idea who these players were. They were minor league players sitting in the cage. And he's going through his whole game plan with every single player. And then he looked at me and he goes, you know, I've faced Tony Gwynn like over 200 times. Don't you think he knows what I'm going to throw?
Yeah.
I said, yeah. And he goes, so the mental part of it is a little bit more important pitching wise and hitting wise. These guys want to make sure that they're in the right position because they know which pitch they're looking for.
Makes sense. Let's go back to batting practice. I'm going to ask you this with BP. What are some of the advice you give other, you know, maybe other coaches about when kids are hitting or players at any level, what are some of the things you're looking at, and also how do you discuss those? Because you mentioned, you know, when he comes out of the cage, how do you talk to them? What's kind of conversation there?
The first thing is there should be a way that you take batting practice, and I don't see it taught or emphasized very much anymore, which is kind of disheartening to me because it's a progression. And just like anybody that's out there that's ever played basketball, you don't start shooting at 3-point range.
Right.
You work in around the basket and you do, you know, a little layup stuff and then you go to the free throw line. And what are you trying to accomplish? A feel. You're trying to figure out what it feels like. And as you move out further, you have a better feel because you're more loose. Well, when you translate that into batting practice, I think you work from opposite field around to pull side. And when I see guys get in there and they'll take 6 or 7 swings and all they do is pull everything, that's like you might as well just be standing right inside of the half court line and shooting 3-pointers from that distance, because all you're doing is swinging. For me, you're not controlling your body, you're not controlling the barrel, and you're not understanding what the contact point is when you hit. And so some guys, you know, they'll ask you to, hey, throw in here. And they want to hit the ball back through the middle because they want to stay on the ball. Other guys will say, hey, throw in because I want to hit 4 or 5 in the seats here to pull, because that ball that's in, I have to get to it. I got to learn how to get to it. As you work around the field, I think you get a better feel and you keep your posture, you keep your balance, you keep your timing. I was fortunate to have Jim Thome when he was really young and in the big leagues, and Manny Ramirez as well. And Manny was phenomenal. His work habits were unbelievable. And he would start by hitting the pole in the cage towards the first baseline.
Wow.
And he would hit that pole 3 or 4 times. I'm like, man, this guy's late, late, late. But he wanted that ball to travel. He wanted to let the ball get there. And then he would start working around. And he would go from line drives to first, line drives to second, and then he would stay in the gaps. But he never wanted to pull anything because he knew that was his strength, and he didn't want to pull off balls because of it. And so his plan really, really, really was – super disciplined. And, you know, after he got to the big leagues before I did as a coach, And then throwing to him in the big leagues, he just came up to me one day and he goes, Dave, I'm sorry, but I can't hit off you. And I'm left-handed. I'm left-handed, but he goes, I can't hit off you anymore. And I said, okay. He goes, your BP's fine. I love hitting off you and everything else, but I don't want to hit off left-handed pitching because it makes me pull off. And if I pull off, then I'm going to do it in the game. And I don't want to do that.
Interesting.
So he wanted to face right-handed pitching during BP because it helped him stay in there. The same thing with Omar Vizquel and Robbie Alomar. They hit left-handed off me all the time because they wanted to stay in there.
Yeah.
Would think as switch hitters that they would have hit right-handed and they didn't want to do that. So one of the most phenomenal stories, and this goes way back because when I worked with Cincinnati, Rose was still there and he was still playing. And I remember getting called up to from minor league camp as my first year coaching up to Al Lopez Field in Tampa and get out on the field, throw BP to a group, and then go to the cage and throw to another group. So I go walking into the cage, and Pete's in there with Johnny Oster and Dan Dreesen. And I'm throwing in the cage to Pete, and he's talking to me the whole time. The whole time he's talking to me. Okay, Dave, I'm going to pull about 10 balls here into the side of the net. Boom, he hit 10 in the net. And it didn't matter where the location of the pitch was. Then you go, okay, heads up, because I'm going to come right back through the middle. Just try to throw it down the middle. If you miss, it doesn't matter. And he would hit balls right past me to the back of the cage. And then he would do the same thing, opposite field. And then he would come out, he would get out of the cage, somebody else would come in and hit, and then he would come back in and do it right-handed. And the whole time I'm throwing BP going, man, this is pretty awesome.
Yeah, special.
Telling me, and you could see that it was the classic case of controlling the barrel.
You know, and speaking about that, it's great segue into, you know, nowadays, you know, fans, I'm sure, and even coaches are asking a lot of times, you know, you got to hold to the left side. And nobody's trying to hit the ball there. Now, understandably, they're, you know, because of the shifts, maybe they're pitching the inside, but you just mentioned that, you know, guys get pitched inside and can hit the other way at times, but yet doesn't happen anymore. Now, I get it that guys are getting paid to hit home runs, but that's really changed the game a lot. Why aren't guys hitting the other way other than because of what they're getting paid?
I think it gets into their head a little bit mentally. When I managed in Daytona in 13 and 14, some of the shifts were going on at A-ball in the Florida State League. And some of our guys were just like in the funk because they weren't used to seeing guys standing in those places.
Right.
And then we went over and played the Phillies in Clearwater, and Mikhail Franco was playing for the Phillies then. He was playing third base for them. And we kind of put a right-handed pull shift onto him, and it got totally into his mind. And he was trying to like hit things to right field. Hit pitches there, and he couldn't do it. So mentally, it can take its toll on guys. But my big concern is we don't ever teach guys to do that. You know, I know that when I was the hitting coordinator, we had instructional leagues where that was part of the guy's plan. During instructional league, every time there's a guy on first base, you have to try to hit it in that hole between first and second.
Right.
And it was so crazy because some guys, it seemed like every at bat they came up for and instructionally when we were playing games, there was a guy in first and they're like, oh my, again? And I'm like, yeah, that's why this is instructional league, because you have to learn how to do that. Because if you can hit that ball in that hole and we got first and third, now you put the pressure on the other team to have to decide what kind of pitching moves they're going to make. And now with all this, the new pitching rules on facing the three batter minimum and all that other stuff, it becomes important for you to find a way to get on base.
Yeah. And what's baffling is, you know, the part that they shift to one side. You know, I was talking to Ken Medlock on the show yesterday and he said, and he was a pitcher. He said, well, they're pitching you inside. They're going to pitch you inside mostly. So now as a hitter, you know they're pitching you inside, but yet you would think the defense wouldn't necessarily set up only for that. I would think they'd be pitching them outside, but yet they can't because the shift changed. I get confused by that.
Yeah, and I think the thing we got to realize is that we're talking about human beings here who are not perfect. Mm-hmm. You know, so even though you set the shift up because of consistencies and paperwork that tells you that that's what goes on, we're still dealing with the human element because those pitchers don't throw every pitch where they want to. Hitters don't hit the ball where they want to all the time. They might be just a tick late, and now they hit the ball to the opposite field because they're late on something, or the ball moved a little bit at the end and they found a way to just flick it out into the outfield. But there's no rule that says that you can't move around in the box either.
Yeah.
And sometimes when you tell hitters, hey, if they're pitching you in, why don't you get off the plate a little bit? If you see the shift, you know how they're going to pitch you. Why don't you get up on top of the plate? And because as soon as you move in the box as a hitter, you know who sees it? The catcher.
Yeah.
And then the catcher has a way of communicating with the pitcher. And then pitchers are going, oh, he just moved in the box. Why did you do that? What am I going to throw now? And if you start creating, to me, hitting wise, if you start creating that doubt in that pitcher's mind or that confusion where he's going, well, how come he's up on top of the plate here? Then you've won a little bit of the battle already before the pitch is even thrown.
So is your recommendation, because this is interesting. I saw Tim Anderson, you know, he must have thought a breaking ball was coming and then he moved up on the plate. Is your recommendation some ways when to do that, I guess, if you're going to move, because one, you're trying to get in the pitcher's head, you want him to see it early, but yet at the same time, you also don't want them to make an adjustment. So when should you move in the plate?
You're making them make an adjustment because of the plan that you want to have, I think, you know, and just like every single guy that's out there, everybody's different. You know, and I got too many stories of situations that have come up where guys have talked about that, you know, where, you know, we were just talking about Pete Rose, but there was a young kid that came up to the big leagues one spring training. His name was Marty Brown. Marty coached over and managed over in Japan with the Hiroshima Carp. And Marty was a good hitter, got to the big leagues, and John Tudor's pitching in the spring training game. And he's sitting there, and Pete looks at him and goes, you know how to hit this guy? He goes, no, I never faced him. And Tudor was a finesse guy with a changeup and stuff, you know?
Yep.
And Pete just said, get up on top of the plate as much as you can, look for a fastball, and hit it off the left center field fence.
Hmm.
First pitch, he hits it off the left center field fence. And I'm sitting there going, is it that easy?
That was easy, yeah.
You know? And then you fast forward about 20 years, and I'm sitting in the dugout in Jacobs Field next to Travis Fryman, who was very analytical, very methodical, great player, tremendous defender. And he comes and sits down, and he goes through this whole scenario of what happened during his at-bat. He goes, the next time, Dave, you know, I'm going to look first pitch. I think he's going to throw me a breaking ball. And if he hangs it, I'm going to hit it up there in the seats by where that guy plays the drum in left field in Jacobs Field. What do you think? And I'm sitting there going, hey, great idea, man. Go
Sounds
for it.
Sounds good.
So he gets a hanging breaking ball and hits it about 10 rows up in left field for a home run.
Yeah.
Comes back to the dugout. He goes, how about that one? I went, pretty good. So it boils down, I think, with everything you're talking about, it boils down to you don't have a fear of being uncomfortable because you're making this plan and you might be thinking you're getting out of your comfort zone a little bit, but if you trust yourself and you can find those hitters and those players, like I think, I haven't seen this kid Anderson playing for the White Sox, but I've heard a lot about him. But, you know, he can get to the point where he says, you know what? I can trust myself. I believe in myself. I'm going to be maybe a little bit out of my comfort zone, but I'm going to risk. I'm going to go for it, you know? So when guys do that, they find out a lot about how they can really handle adversity.
Yeah, you could tell Tim. You could tell Tim Anderson's got both of those. He's got a plan, and he's not afraid to make a mistake or take a risk. What about, you know, in the big leagues, and you guys even possibly in the minors, you guys have a lot of tape. You see the same pitchers all the time. What about recommendations when it comes to players or coaches that are working with players that you don't see that pitcher very often? How to have a plan against that pitcher that you don't see, that you don't know anything about?
Then I think you got to keep it really simple. And the easiest way to do it, and some people think it's kind of corny, but every guy that's a pitcher that walks out to that pitcher's mound, even those guys that throw knuckleballs, everybody throws a fastball. And the whole idea and the whole aspect and the whole philosophy behind hitting is timing off of fastball. So when you get into a jam and get into a corner and you're like, anybody ever seen this guy before? No. Well, just look for fastball because you know he's going to throw it.
Right.
And even like, I remember when I first came over with the Cubs, we had Kyle Farnsworth, who was pitching out of the bullpen in the big leagues.
I remember
that. Threw 97, 98 miles an hour.
Yep.
And he never threw a fastball. He threw 10, 12, 13 sliders in a row coming in relief. So right away, you can say, hey, I'm not going to look for a fastball because he's not going to throw it. So now I can set up my timing, and those guys are good enough at that level to be able to understand that. And they can trust themselves to say, you know what? He's going to hang one of these sliders, and I'm going to be on it. I'm going to be ready for it.
All right, the million-dollar question, because you mentioned timing. Some ways to possibly teach timing, how to work on it. Because one thing you see, we see a lot of guys at the younger levels, you know, they'll work batting practice, the fastball, but yet our young kids don't see off-speed pitches a lot. Then they get into a game, they see an off-speed pitch, don't know how to time it. I know it's a whole show in itself, but some general ideas about, you know, how you work with young players with timing, understanding how to time a pitch, how to be on time. And I'm guessing that you're not always going to be on time. So don't you also have to understand what to do when you're off time, but yet you started your swing?
Absolutely. And especially on off speed stuff. I think that number one, sometimes when I'm talking to younger guys and doing camps and there's kids that are high school age and some of our younger, lower level kids, you start talking about the finish and the way they finish their swing. And if I told you right away, okay, Ken Griffey Jr., you'd have this image in your mind of that big finish that he always had.
Yep.
But if you go back and look, a lot of those big finish swings that he has and those, a lot of left-handed hitters where you go, wow, he's got a sweet swing. And right-handed hitters like Edgar Martinez, those guys had a big finish because it was off speed, because most of the time it was changeups. And so those guys figure out how to stay through the ball longer and don't get too concerned about maybe getting off your backside a little bit, but keep your bat speed and stay through the hitting zone. Whereas a lot of younger hitters and undisciplined hitters, they just pull off and they pull out of there. So there's no way that their barrel is ever going to stay in the hitting zone long enough for them to hit the ball. So with that being said, I started doing a drill about 20 years ago, probably. And I call it the three ball drill. And you set up the hack attack on breaking balls. Mm. And so to teach timing, to teach balance, to teach tracking with your eyes, the first pitch that you get, you take it and you take it all the way to the catcher's glove. So that'll slow your body down, slow your front side down, and you watch the curveball actually break and you watch it go behind you. The second ball, you go to contact and stop. And that gives you a chance to feel where the contact is in relationship to your front foot, because mm-hmm. breaking balls, if you make contact out in front of your front foot, 90% of the time, it's a rollover to pull side, which is exactly why the pitcher's throwing the pitch, mm-hmm. to get you out front enough to where you roll your hands over and then you pull the ball on the ground. So by doing that, you take it to contact and stopped. and they should hit like a little line drive over the pitcher's direction, or a little bit towards the opposite, like righties would go towards, this is right on right, left on left. Right-handed hitters would go towards second base. Lefties would go more towards shortstop. That's the second pitch. The third pitch, go for it.
Love
hit it. So this progression part of the teaching that you're doing, in the long run, what it does is it helps the kids understand the feel. It helps them see and feel. Because as coaches, we're standing there the whole time and we can see everything that's going on. And we have to be able to get the point across to them. What'd that feel like? What'd it feel like? Did you like that? Did it feel good? Did it feel relaxed? Because those two things have to be delivered to the player. They have to be something that the player does not get confused about. If I talk about seeing something or feeling it, and if they don't feel it, then we have to be able to move their body so they can feel it. And I don't see coaches do that much anymore. When a guy strides or when a guy is doing something with his swing, people don't show players how to move. They just try to tell them with words, hey, do this, blah, 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 blah. And so it becomes this quick troubleshooting kind of thing. And then the next thing you know, they're going, well, it's away. Should I move up on the plate? Well, no. And then he throws me inside. Should I get off the plate? And then you go down that really bad rabbit hole of just total guessing and total craziness.
Yeah, I think we've all fallen in. If you've been in the game long enough, you've fallen into this, where I know I've done it in my lifetime, and I've shown it. And you expect, because I showed it to them, that they're going to do it all of a sudden. And that's what I love about this drill. This is drill covers everything you need to know, whether it's vision, tracking, staying through a pitch, because you hear that a lot, staying through. But yet, how do you teach it? What a perfect way. And I'll tell you this. Here's another part I love about it, because it's going to go back to Pepper. And it's interesting enough. One thing I just did on my own, when I was playing Pepper and with our kids, I then figured out, you know what, why are we knocking the ball into the ground? You know, the old Pepper where you chopped it down. I said, let's stop that. Let's stop the bat at contact, exactly what you said, and let's just hit a line drive back at the person. Because now, kids are going to throw the ball different speeds because they don't always throw it right. So all of a sudden, you know, I'm going to feel myself off balance if I'm mistiming the throw he just made, if I'm trying to be at contact. So I'm with you. I love that. All of this stuff that you're talking about, critical that our coaches understand. This has got to be practiced a lot in practice before you expect them to do it in a real game.
Yeah, and there's a progression part of all of this. You know, when guys go into the cage and they hit off the tee, they should be pretty close to being perfect because the ball's not moving very much at all, you know, not at all. So right. You move that tee wherever you want to, and they should be able to repeat a swing and keep their balance and repeat a location wherever you want them to hit it. And so when you get past the tee, then you can go to whatever side toss or front toss. And then after that, you keep moving on until you get outside. And now when we take BP, you're going to slip a little bit because there's the ball's traveling, you're outside. Right. There's a little bit of a difference. And then you're trying to go, how many times have we had, there's 50 million players that people go, man, this guy in BP, he's lights out, man. This guy's unbelievable. Right. This guy's awesome in BP. And the game comes.
That was me.
Mr. Hyde.
Yeah. Couldn't hit with the game at all.
But that's the game. And that's why the game is so hard. And that's why we have to realize as coaches that this game is really, really, really hard. And the hardest thing in the world to do is hit. And now with the advancement that I think the pitchers have kind of gotten ahead of the curve here a little bit as versus the hitters.
Right.
10 or 15, 20 years ago, even with the special vitamins, the hitters were ahead of the game. You know, they were ahead of the pitching. And so back then, everybody was like, well, what are we going to do? Okay, sinker, slider. keep, make them hit it in the ground, hit it in the ground. Because if they hit it in the air, it's a homer because these guys are so big and strong. And then after all that stuff changes, now it becomes high fastball. Throw the high fastball because everybody was saying, get the ball in the air, get the ball in the air, hit it in the air so you can hit it in the seats. Well, we found out right away how those strikeout numbers came up. People got left on base. There was so much stuff that happened until they brought in those Pro V balls from 2 years ago or last year or whatever.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, and that's when the home runs took off in AAA, but, and the big leagues, but home runs are up, but strikeouts are even higher.
And Dave, you know? So to that point, now you're the hitting guy. What do we do now as hitters? Because hitters have to catch up now at any level, even at the youth, at the travel level, we're getting more velocity. We're seeing more velocity. So now what does the hitter do or the coach do to help the hitter catch up to the pitchers?
I think you really have to talk about timing and you really have to talk about what it means to be on time and what happens when your front foot hits the ground. Where should my barrel be? Because that's why they're throwing all these high fastballs, because they're so hard to hit because it's so hard and guys don't get ready soon enough. So trying to get those guys to stay off those pitches is hard when you get ready late.
Mm-hmm.
When you're ready early, you stay off of them because your eyes tell you that that ball is close to chest high or shoulder high and guys won't swing. But because I think there's been this huge push to get the ball in the air, get the ball in the air, get the ball in the air. Well, you know, there's not very many guys that can hit the ball out of the ballpark on a consistent basis. And so if I'm asking you to hit the ball in the air and you keep hitting balls right before the warning track and you come back to the dugout and you're like, man, I hit that ball really good. Yeah, F7, F8. F9, that's an at bat. You're not on base. Oh, by the way, you can run. You're a really good runner, but you can't get on base because you hit all these fly balls. So now what are you going to do? Because nobody wants to bunt anymore and nobody hitting runs anymore.
Right.
But I know that we did in 1998, when I worked in the fall league, John McDonald was playing with the Indians and Robbie Alomar and Omar Vizquel were in awe of John McDonald. And I don't know if you remember him or not. Some people maybe do.
No.
But he went to Providence. He was a shortstop, and he was a wizard. He was one of the best defenders that I've ever seen, ever. And John came to the fall league because we had to reconstruct his whole swing. Because everything was fly balls, 250-foot, 260-foot fly balls. So we changed his swing the whole fall league. And next thing you know, he stays in the big leagues for about 6 or 7 more years because his defense was off the charts. He was an unbelievable defender. But he changed himself to inside out balls, stay on top of balls, hit ground balls, hit line drives, instead of this fly ball deal where he was hitting 210 in double A. So there's tons of stories with each player, but I think the theme that everybody should realize is that the player was willing to make the change because he knew he was stuck. He knew he was in front of that wall and he couldn't knock the wall down unless he made a change.
Makes sense. You know, on that, as we're talking here, we're almost at the end. I really appreciate it. I want to get into a couple things about the Dominican Republic Latin players because, you know, again, that could be a whole show. I may have to have you back just on Latin America, because I think that's a thing to talk about. I think we could learn so much from there. But on it, what you're hearing now a little bit more, you're hearing minor league systems, and I may be wrong, but at least something I've been listening, that they're starting to change batting practice a little bit. And I've always thought about this, and we've done it in the past because we've watched the Japanese do it, and that is kind of split batting practice where, you know, your first phase might be your hitting phase where you're getting a feel, you're moving the ball in certain areas, what you talked about earlier. But then the next phase is actually facing live pitching more. Have you seen that? Have you heard? Is it good? You know, we're now batting practice, you're actually facing live pitchers?
I think that's more for the pitchers personally. Yeah, you're facing live BP, but they want, they being, I would say most of the pitching coach population that's out there, they want their hitters, they want their pitchers to face hitters. Because anybody and their brother can go down to the bullpen and throw a bullpen and throw strikes.
Right.
But when you put a different uniform in that box that has to hit off of you, then we have adrenaline, we have anxiety, we have all this, all these outside distractions that come into play. So I get in conversations with our pitching guys a lot because I don't think our pitchers throw off the mound enough. And they throw this thing called flat ground that drives me nuts.
Right.
But if you throw off the mound, you can't help but feel more comfortable as time goes by.
Sure.
And as a hitter, if you can face pitching and face those guys live, then you're talking about the speed element. And so it's, I think it's easier over time to teach your eyes how to slow things down at a higher speed. Forever, big league players hate the first couple days when the pitchers throw live BP in spring training because the ball looks like it's about 120 miles an hour and it's smaller than a golf ball because they're not used to seeing it. But pitchers need that. Hitters need to see the velocity. And the only way we can do it really right now is with a hack attack machine, you know, to where we can crank it up. But you got to be careful because if you crank it up too high, then you defeat the purpose for the hitter. And all they do is, because you get jammed one time, man, it feels like your thumb is like totally gone. And it's really hard to get to the player to go, come on, man, stay in there and swing. Yeah, right. I'm staying in there.
Yeah, right.
So it's a fine line on how much velocity, you know. And if you train at a higher velocity, then your eyes can kind of slow it down. I don't know if you've ever seen those tennis ball machines that they used to have.
At their high speeds.
Yeah, we had a guy that came to Cleveland all the time, and Robbie loved those. And he was amazing. I mean, at 120, 125 miles an hour, he's telling me color, number, and I'm going, no way. This is, and the ball would stop behind. And I'd look, and that's exactly what it was, you know. But I got on that and did that a lot just to see what the drill was like. And so it's kind of a pyramid effect where you start out slow, you get up to about 130, 135 miles an hour, and then go back to 90. And at 90, everything's super clear. So vision-wise, those things, they can help you. It's just kind of a moderation in all things, I would suggest.
You know, it's interesting you said hack attack or pitching machine. You know, when I was playing, I used to complain all the time, I don't like the pitch machine because you got to time it. Well, maybe I should have been working on that more because I just saw on MLB Network, I can't quote who it was a pretty good hitter. He loves the batting, the machine for batting practice simply because it does help your timing. That's what he said.
Well, I think what he's saying is, I know I got to get ready.
Right.
Early,
yeah,
because when you get ready late, you have a really hard time succeeding as a hitter unless you really just inside out everything really bad and you get caught deep and you're not worried about it, you know. But I came up as an early coach and was around and played against Kevin Seitzer, who played with Kansas City for a long time. I don't know if he's still working with Atlanta or not, but he was an inside-out guy. He hit everything to right center and right field. Everything as a right-handed hitter. And coming up through the minor leagues, he was 340 every year. So he wasn't worried about the ball getting too deep, you know, because he knew how to get the barrel in the right position to hit it. So with so much speed going on with pitchers now, it's a really tough – it makes it even tougher to hit.
Yeah, and it makes sense for our young coaches and players. Yeah, you got to work on your timing even more nowadays. You have to understand it better. You know, finally, Dave, and you've been great. I really appreciate this. Finally, on the end, you know, I want to mention Latin American players. You know, you know, as you know, I've been going to Latin America a long time. I was an independent ball, so I had to sign a lot of players. I love signing Latin players. And, you know, the reason I loved it was, one, they have a passion for the game. Two, obviously great athletes. Independent ball sometimes was a little tougher because they weren't as developed and we weren't looking for guys to develop. We were looking for guys that can produce right now. But I would love to get your take, you know, because you run the academy in Latin America, your field coordinator for the Cubs. I guess the hitting part, what's the difference between Latin hitters and any other hitters, whether it's U.S. or anybody else around the world? What do you see the difference in the two when you get them?
Well, the first thing is you got to look at physical development. So if you can try to understand the physical development with each guy, then you can understand why they swing the way they do. For so long, those kids were underdeveloped physically. And so when you saw a guy that was kind of a wiry body guy that had bat speed, it was like, this guy's going to translate to be able to hit fastballs when he comes to the States. So what ended up happening was they said, okay, just throw him breaking balls because he's never seen them and he doesn't know how to react to them and he can't adjust to them and everything. But over time now, the Latin players are bigger and stronger when we sign them. Whereas before, they were skinny and they were underdeveloped. So because of that, you'll run into some players that have to overcompensate physically with, usually what happens is it happens with their load. And when their trigger or their coil or whatever you want to call it, when they get ready to hit, they have to almost load up too much because they don't have enough strength yet. So those are some of the things that you see are bad habits that players have. And it happens with pitchers. It happens with guys that are thrown across the infield. When you see a guy that's got to try to generate more power because he doesn't have any strength yet, you understand that. Most of the reasons why those kids overexert themselves is because they don't have enough strength yet and they haven't developed yet. So that's one of the things that, you know, everybody's trying to deal with. And I just hope that we, after doing this job I have now for 6 years, it's like, don't put the cart before the horse. Mm. You know, they want the guy to be this big, strong looking guy when he comes to the States. And you have to realize that they don't start filling out until they get to about 20 or 21, which means that we can hopefully have them in A ball by that time. And then when they fill out at 22 and 23, they're ready to play at the higher levels. But you can't try to get them to gain 15 pounds of muscle. And I think more important than anything else is that young age, you have to create that whole foundation for them with their work habits. Teach them why you have to do it that way, why it's important, how it's going to help you in the future, because it's so different in Latin America now than it was 10 years ago, 15 years ago. I started going down there in 98, and it's way different now. The way that the kids are taken care of is so different, so different. They're fed so unbelievably great all the time, all the accommodations. And this is every organization too. It's not just ours. Everybody's, they feed their players. They got weight rooms. They have entertainment rooms. They have Wi-Fi. So if they have Wi-Fi there, everything's great.
Yeah, that makes sense. You know, finally, let's end it with this. And then, like I said, we'd love to have you back on a show. Let's talk Latin American baseball. Matter of fact, it might be kind of cool as I think about it to, you know, maybe have 2-3 people on that have, you know, international experience in Latin America and get different perspectives. I think that'd be a great show. Finally, you know, I heard you talk at the Colorado Zoom call, you know, and we all know, you know, I'm a little lucky because I speak Italian, so I've been in Latin America a lot, so the Spanish is fairly easy for me. But I also think when I'm working with a Latin player, I kind of like that I don't know Latin that well, because that way I do less talking, but yet we do more work in some ways. Does that make any sense?
Absolutely. And the problem that I run into is because I speak Spanish, I kind of can become an enabler because yeah. I'm, helping them with their English as much as they need to, because that's a huge part of the transition that those kids have to make from Latin America and the Dominican to coming to the United States, to wherever their spring training facility is or wherever their teams are.
Yeah.
They have, that's, and we have found that you pick up English quicker, you learn the language quicker, you succeed on the field quicker and at a better rate. So it's important for those kids to understand that, you know, and just the look on their face when they come up to you with a big, huge smile and they put together a whole sentence in English.
Yep.
And they're so proud of themselves. And they're like, how was that? Was that good? And you're like, that was awesome, man. Perfect. That whole pride thing comes into play. Then they feel a lot more self-confident about how they go about their day.
You know what? I was going to end it, but I got to add one more thing, and I got to mention this. I apologize. It's because it's something I really love, and that is, you talked about being uncomfortable before. You mentioned the word a couple times, and, you know, people always ask me about Latin players. I said, well, the reason they're so good is because look at what they play on. Look at what they have. And I'm not talking about at the Cubs Academy or the Major League Academies. I'm talking about the academies where they're at their local areas. I mean, no fields. The balls are all messed up. You know, they're throwing different size balls all the time, different weights. You know, they never had the same ball. And all of a sudden they get to where they're playing with you guys, and it's like, man, this is the field we're going to play on? I mean, this is too easy for us. Let's end it with what you think about that.
Next time we come on, we can talk more about, because I know exactly what you're talking about with the fields and why those guys for so long fielded balls on the side, running as fast as they can and keeping
right.
them and everything, because it was kind of a self-preservation thing.
Right, right.
But that's how things have changed down there in a really, really, really positive way, because some, just like I would imagine some of the places that you've been internationally, it's just like, you go, how in the world could these kids be living here, eating here, sleeping here, and playing on this field right here? And that guy over there, he's going to play in the major leagues and he's going to be an all-star player in the big leagues. That's unbelievable to think that, but that's what happened. And, I was really fortunate when I worked with the Indians. We had a lot of the young Latin players down there with Julian Tavares, Bartolo Colon, Johnny Peralta. And they were living in that, in Santo Domingo.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's crazy to look back now at what those facilities were like, because everybody's got great facilities now. You know, it's totally different.
Yeah, I agree. And if you've done your homework, folks, you look around the world, look at the top sports, look at the Olympics, some of your top athletes that come from different countries come from facilities that are, you would never want to be in some of those facilities. Take your long distance runners, your sprinters. I mean, you just do your history, you'll see it. So there is some truth to, you know, when you're uncomfortable, you do become a little bit better at what you do. Dave, man, this has been awesome. We got to get you back for the Latin America section, man. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Thank you.
All right, folks, that is it. Fantastic show. That's Dave Keller with the Chicago Cubs. Of course, I'm from Chicago, a favorite. I love the Cubs, and I will always follow them. Special thanks to our producer, Brian Kroc, with the Lineup Media Group, and also our special thanks to everybody in the U.S. and around the world. Thanks for being on Facebook, and appreciate you joining us. Don't forget, we're live on YouTube, Peter Caliendo. Go there and subscribe. Do us that favor. Other than that, want to wish you the best, everybody. Stay safe. Stay healthy. Hopefully you'll be back on the field soon. If you're not, God bless you all, and we'll see you on the next show.
This has been Baseball Outside the Box with Peter Caliendo. Listen online at baseballoutsidethebox.com and subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and all major podcast outlets. Join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter. Get all of our podcasts now at lineupmedia.fm.